Hi, I'm Max Kaiser. This is the Kaiser Report. You know, America's becoming one big ghetto with heroin Eric nodding out everywhere across every socioeconomic plane of existence, every group. Stacey.
Well, Max, the thing you're trying to bring up is the fact that if you tune into the news, where you go to look for analysis of what is happening in your economy, what is happening in your culture, your politics, to understand the world around you, it's all Russia, 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 Russia. In the meantime, I think Russia's like 5,000 or 6,000 miles, 8,000 miles from here. Well, if you count the whole country, it's like thousands and thousands of miles across Russia. But right here, in this country, I saw this image. It's a video of these clerks at a gas station shop. You know, we've just driven across the country, and there are many of these gas stations, little convenience stores on the gas station. And here are these two women nodding off while the customer is trying to pay for her goods. And it just made me feel so sad for the fact that this is happening here in this country, and nobody is talking about it or putting into context what is going wrong, what is wrong.
Yeah, well, it's called the ghettoification of America. And if you listen to Gil Scott Heron, one of the seminal street poets, spoken word geniuses of our era, you know, you would know that this was coming. Basically, America doesn't want to deal with the fact that it's been abusive toward its minority population and put them into economically disadvantageous ghettos, which have led to drug use, heroin use, and all kinds of problems. And as a result of the necessary infrastructure of prisons to maintain the ghetto of America, primarily the black population, there's no more money left for the white population. So the ghettoification of America is spilling over now. And you, obviously, you've got these two white women.
Well, that's what I want to say, okay. But the fact is, what I think is actually the problem relates to our first headline here.
Yeah.
And that is the copyright cartels, the sort of oligarchization of America. The fact that basically we have a Pablo Escobar-like situation. You and I covered it before on the tobacco trail, the carnage trail. Here, this town, Durham, North Carolina, was built on the tobacco industry, the cartel that the Duke family ran of the tobacco industry. Today, we have an opioid epidemic because of the cartels from Connecticut, the family in Connecticut that runs the opioid epidemic. But now, this also, the fact that we have these oligarchies has basically led to a situation where not only are we pushing drugs on people, but there's no hope of ever rising, because here's a study, and this is from the New York Times, this headline, Myths of the 1%. What puts people at the top? Dispelling misconceptions about what's driving income inequality in the U.S. So the study looks at all of the myths of what's causing inequality in the U.S., why the 1% owns 20% of all the wealth in the United States. And it basically, they look at all the other OECD nations, and by comparing the arguments, they can find out that it's not trade, it's not the rise of information technology, it's not about unions, and it's not about immigration either. Because if you look at other nations with more immigration or more trade or more IT than America, they don't have the same situation. And what they found is that it's actually basically the cartels or the government intervention in certain industries. And we'll go into that in specifics, but it's things like, you know, the fact that to cut hair in the United States, you have to spend like $2,000 to get a license in many states just to have the right to cut hair. There, like, so barriers to entry have been erected all over the economy, all over through various services and stuff.
Right, the oligarchs, the wealth concentration, the bureaucratic concentration is sapping the economic vitality from this entrepreneurial nation called America, and the machinations and the costs associated therewith of keeping this huge prison population in place are draining money away from all aspects of society. And you've got the problems that you would normally associate with the ghetto, like people nodding out in the middle of the day, on the middle of the street, heroin nod, just nodding out. Like you'd, I lived in Harlem for 4 years, and I'm quite familiar with what happens to a community when it's run by heroin gangsters and what this does to folks. And now we're seeing it across every socioeconomic strata of America because the same frickin' gangsters are running all of society, the same drug pushers and opiate pushers that we used to condemn in places like Harlem and other urban areas are now running economic policy in America. So we got a nation of frickin' nod and heroin addicts down there at the convenience store. You know, all jacked up, looking for a hit. You know, and frickin' crack whores are running everything in America.
The crack was jacked up. These people just want to nod out because, like, this study, by the way, is by Jonathan Rothwell, and he's a senior economist at Gallup. And when you're talking about the 1980s, when Gil Scott-Heron was alive and kicking and offering his poetry to the world and explaining the situation of the ghetto, of American society, of the B movie sort of vacation of America. So, okay, you can't because of copyright cartels, you can't even do that. So, the fact is that in 1980, the top 1% owned, their share of the national income was 11%. In 2014, it was 20%, and it's increased even more. No other nation in the 35-member Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, is as unequal among those with comparable tax data, and none have experienced such a sharp rise in inequality. So what's going on? The Gallup economist looked, and he said that almost all of the growth and top American earners has come from just three economic sectors: professional services, finance and insurance, and healthcare, groups that tend to benefit from regulatory barriers that shelter them from competition. Of course, we've talked about Obamacare. This is like part of the health cartel is right here behind us. Duke is like part of that whole cartel system of healthcare in America. But they have benefited from the regulatory barriers. Dean Baker, he's covered, the economist in out of Washington, D.C., he's covered the fact that doctors, for example, you can't just, we can't import through immigration doctors because they need to get all the medical certification here in the United States. Even if they've been trained in France or Germany or United Kingdom, anywhere in Europe, they or Hong Kong or Singapore, great doctors, great healthcare systems there. They can't just come here and start offering services to Americans. They have to get, you know, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to get the certification required to practice here.
My sister Nell got bit by a rat.
Yeah.
And Whitey's on the moon. You know, the revolution will not be televised. Ain't nothing but a B movie. The fact is you've got regulatory capture. You've got the capture of these industries of the American economy, and they're beating the hell out of people every single day. This is like the Harvey Weinsteinization of the American economy, where everyone is just getting unmercifully violated 24/7 by these cartel, you know, snot-nosed jerk-offs that are just
So let's talk more sophisticated language here to offer better poetry than what you're doing here. So the groups that have contributed most to the 1% since 1980 are physicians, executive managers, sales supervisors, and analysts working in the financial sectors, and professionals in legal service industry, executives, managers, lawyers, consultants, and sales reps. So all the protected industries. Without the changes to these largely domestic service industries, finance, healthcare, and the law, the United States would look like Canada or Germany in terms of the top income shares. So again, remember, by the way, we're outside. You might hear some airplanes. You might see there's some Amtrak train going past by there. You might hear noises around us, just so you know, there's noises. But here, so you don't see, checkout counter staff. If you're driving across Germany on the Autobahn, you don't see people nodding off at the checkout counter there because, of course, they've got some dignity. They have hope. They have hope that, that the government's not going to prevent them from accessing the economy around them.
Right. You mentioned the government there is not going to allow for certain things. And, of course, in America, there's a huge population that equates the government with something diabolical and evil, even though the government is the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The government is the what?
Yeah, well, that's right. I'm like nodding with you.
You're nodding? With you. Not opening
and
it well, out.
But I'm not nodding.
You're not
off.
Nodding out.
I'm nodding agreement.
Oh, yes.
And however, here they are saying that the government in the United States is owned by specific groups of industries that are setting up regulatory barriers to anybody entering that system. That's why I think every millennial in the United States runs a coffee shop, because there's no cartel for coffee, apparently. But the problems, so they go through why these industries are protected and how they're protected. And what they say is that the problems cited by these analysts include subsidies for the financial sector's risk-taking, overprotection of software and pharmaceutical patents, the escalation of land use controls that drive up rents in desirable metropolitan areas, favoritism toward market incumbents via state occupational licensing regulations, for example, associations representing lawyers, doctors, and dentists that block efforts allowing paraprofessionals to provide routine services at a lower price without their supervision. So the government is erecting barriers. I will nod agreement with that.
Well, look, here's the big secret. In America, there is no government. There are only corporations.
Yes, and we're actually going to talk about that soon. I want to talk about this Amazon headquarters, and this is very important that your cities, I mean, we are entering a neo-feudal corporate state for sure, and I think what we see with Amazon basically pitching for a second headquarters is pretty remarkable.
Right, as part of the deal, they are offered to actually run the government in these towns that they're pitching for. Much more about this coming your way, don't go away. Right after the break.
For many clubs over the years, so I know the game inside out. Football isn't only about what happens on the pitch or the final score. It's about the passion from the fans. It's the age of the super manager, billionaire owners, and spending $220 million on one player. But it's an experience like nothing else on earth. And because I want to share what I think and what I know about the beautiful game, I agreed to one more transfer. And this is my new team.
Afghanistan is not a good place. It's not a good country. And چون کسی که با شهرت میرسه خیلی برش خطرناک است با افغانستان.
قبل از اینکه به شهرت برسه دوستا در فیسبوک دوستای مکتب در کوچه همسایه ها حتی قوم خیش برش میگفت که تو هم شکل بروسلی است.
فامیلیم کس برادرهایم به اسم عباس سلام میکنم و مردم افغانستان وقتی بیرون میرم بروسلی افغانستان سلام میکنم.
و این عباس علی که خود به بروسلی به اصطلاح عرضه کرده و در جهان فعلا به اصطلاح مشهور است و را تایید نمیکنه دین مردود است قبول نیست و اسلام رد میکنه هر آن عملی که
و همیشه تمرین کنه چون اتفاق نمیکنه او این مسلمان است یا او نبود اتفاق نمیکنه.
یک چیزی شده که مثال یک نفر به شبیه بروسلی بر آمده یاد بروسلی زنده میکنه باعث از این میشه که دوباره بروسلی در عرصه سینما برگرده یا در ورزش بسیاری خوب است برای رشد ورزش.
Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to continue with our conversation with Jameson Lopp. Welcome back. So you're a third generation North Carolinian.
I am.
And your avatar on Twitter, you're smoking a cigar and I think you're shooting a gun.
Well, I've got my Make Bitcoin Great Again hat on.
Yeah.
I may or may not be holding a gun. You can't tell.
I can't tell, but I've seen some other photos. You're holding guns. Now, you talk about Bitcoin in terms of individual sovereignty. It's one of the things that I really like about your approach to this. And can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Sure. I mean, to me, the reason that we got into this entire mess and created this Bitcoin software and everything that has spawned off of it is simply because we, for generations, if not, you know, the entire sum of human history, have put trust in other people to take care of the accounting ledgers, to take care of really power in general, you know, creating these hierarchical power structures. And it makes sense that that has happened. You know, it's more efficient. It allows society to work pretty smoothly, but you're making a lot of trade-offs. You're handing over a lot of your own power to somebody else in order for you to go about your life, you know, being an ignorant fool, but happy.
Right. The layers of trust in the system, you know, when you think about it, everything we do, you're on the road, you're driving, you're getting your licenses, you're starting a business, you're various institutions, and everything is layers of trust, and there's government layers of trust. And so Bitcoin essentially has reinvented how we manage trust in our society, because it's through this protocol that is developed consensus, which is not centralized. And because it's electronic and digital, it's frictionless, or the cost is almost zero. I mean, going back to the old days, I lived in a little town in the south of France called Villefranche-sur-Mer, which started with pirates saying to the residents, you know, give us a yearly sum of cash and we'll protect you with our pirate ships, right? I mean, that's the history of society, is that you mercenaries protect the town. And now that's not really needed anymore, right?
Well, at least from the monetary standpoint, we said, hey, we can flip this whole model upside down. And instead of us trusting, you know, certain entities, instead we are gonna track everything ourselves. We are gonna, you know, validate our rules, and we're not gonna trust anybody. And then we'll just create protocols and use the technology that has been developed over the past generation or so in order to be able to automate our communication and automate our trust with each other.
Let's talk about the intrinsic value of Bitcoin for a second, because one of the easiest ways you can make the case is to say, well, look at the protocol behind email. Right? Or the internet itself. Mm-hmm. Anyone can come up with a new email protocol. But at this point, it's so entrenched and so universal and so prolific and out there that the chances of that are very small. The people who argue, who are in the gold camp, who say it has no intrinsic value, don't understand that aspect of it. And they don't accept the fact that, well, yeah, you could come up with a new email protocol, but I could also mine gold on an asteroid. I could also mine gold from the sea. The probability is minute, so it's not worth considering. What do you think of that?
It's kind of funny, because I actually worked on email platforms before I got into Bitcoin. And yeah, I mean, email protocol, it's very old, it's outdated, it's simple. There's so many things you could do to make it better, but the network effect is so huge. Nobody wants to try to overcome that network effect. It's just not worth it at this point. We just build more stuff on top of it, keep going. It works fine.
That's essentially Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And there's a few examples of this protocol throughout the technology industry. The HTTP protocol, you know, these are protocols that are prolific, et cetera, that have a huge value. And can you build on that a little bit more?
We have these protocols that have, over the years, become very stable. People have come to learn, I guess, the kind of eccentricities about them. And it's become a standard. And so once you have that standard, it's hard to change it, but you can try to extend it and, you know, add more things on top of it, or even, you know, create other layers on top of it. So I think that that's kind of the perspective that a lot of people on the Bitcoin side are seeing, is, you know, extend and build on top of rather than try to replace, which is what some people are trying to do. But there's just a lot more technical and human challenges to overcome if you want to do that.
It seems that despite the efforts of big banks now like JP Morgan or countries like China to try to derail the Bitcoin freight train, they're failing. Is this the genius of Satoshi, and where is this going?
Well, you know, it was probably inevitable. Satoshi just happened to be that lucky person or group of persons who really found the right combination of technologies and game theory to put it all together. I mean, this goes back decades, so somebody was probably going to figure out eventually.
Right, you have three things that I see. You have game theory, you have Metcalfe's law, which is the networking effect, essentially, where you have increased returns economics at play, the mushrooming, the old example of the fax machine, you know, one fax machine is worthless, two fax machines are kind of interesting, but once you get to three fax machines and four, the value of the network expands exponentially with each new node, right?
Yep.
So this is Metcalfe's law. Then you have to add to that Thayer's law of good money chasing out bad. You put those three things together, as it's done in this protocol, and you end up with a runaway freight train of value asset trading that is undefeatable, and we're at the space where, do you agree with that assessment?
That seems to be the case so far. There are, you know, plenty of skeptics out there who believe that, you know, something even better than Bitcoin will come in and replace it, and you know, the market will decide, but so far so good.
Futures contracts are being launched in Wall Street's getting into the game. A lot of people say, well, you know, in the gold market, the problem is all these futures contracts, they manipulate the price and they're keeping the lid on gold prices. How do you see that playing out in the Bitcoin space?
There are some people who think that, you know, it's going to short Bitcoin into the ground. But I think that a more likely outcome is that, you know, shorting Bitcoin is a terrible idea. Anyone who tries to do that is going to get wrecked pretty hard.
Well, let me ask you this. So, in other words, if you look at what's happening with Patrick Byrne over there at Overstock, he's launching T0, which is zero confirmation date, which is the trading in Bitcoin is the confirmation. It totally disintermediates Wall Street. The total apparatus needed to do naked short selling and all the things that have crippled the gold market for so long are going to be blown away as adoption of Bitcoin takes hold. So initially, you might have some of this problem. But the protocol is going to kill those guys. It's going to kill them deader than a bag of doornails.
Well, and this is just a transitional period, right? I mean, when we're still using the dollar as the unit of account, where what we're trying to get to is the point where we're using Bitcoin as a unit of account. So I think it's only going to, you know, last for so many years before we get to that hyper-Bitcoinization that some people are dreaming of.
Right. Well, I mean, Patrick Byrne Overstock is it just angers me to think that there's still Jamie Dimon is still breathing oxygen in this world. That serial terrorist like that. Anyway, let me move on. So you self-identify as a cypherpunk. What is this all about?
So the cypherpunks, the origin of the movement really goes back to the 80s, a bunch of nerds who, they saw the promise of the internet and these new communications technologies, but they also saw the dark side. They saw what could happen as a, you know, surveillance state comes in and uses these technologies for evil, basically. So they wanted to build privacy-enhancing technologies into the internet itself on top of the internet protocols. And it just so happened that, you know, digital money was one of those very interesting things that the cypherpunks thought was important for society to have. And a number of cypherpunks worked on it for decades, and it wasn't until 2009 that, you know, Satoshi came along and actually had an elegant solution. There were many, many attempts and failed solutions that happened before Bitcoin.
There are estimated 4 million Bitcoins now that are lost. You know, I've lost God knows how many Bitcoin, enough to buy this building probably. what do you think about this? So the actual effective number will not be 21 million in total. It'll be probably closer to 17 million.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on this?
And we'll never know for sure. I mean, you can use various methods to try to estimate that. But that's kind of part of the game, right? Is that this is a lesson in responsibility. I mean, it's a lesson in self-sovereignty, which means responsibility. So the people who get into Bitcoin without understanding what they're getting into, they may get hacked, but more likely they're just going to be negligent and they're going to lose their Bitcoins. And that will be their learning lesson.
Yeah, I mean, every day people are saying, I had a thumb drive, I had a hard drive, I had a paper wallet, you know, with a few Bitcoins on it. I don't know where it is. I lost it. I threw it away. I gave it away. And now this is quite meaningful in terms of dollars and cents. And that's the learning lesson. So what are your guide to Bitcoin survival? Because you're somebody who seems to keep your equanimity intact throughout all the drama and all the price moves. How do you do it? What's your guide to survival, Jameson Lopp?
Lots of backups, lots of testing. I mean, the main problem right now is that there is such a high learning curve. And so I just tell people, you know, do not put any money into it until you feel like you understand it enough to be safe. And so that, for some people, that means just copping out and you know, sending their coins to Coinbase or Zappo or some trusted provider. For a lot of people, that may be a safer option. But if you really want to go like full self-sovereignty, full responsibility, you need to put in the effort. And it's, we're talking not just hours, but probably days, if not weeks, of effort of teaching yourself and then actually going through the motions of testing and doing the appropriate security measures. And I have plenty of articles and blog posts about the minutia of that.
Yeah, yeah. What's the website with all the links that you have?
Everything can be found on lop.net.
Lop.net. And yeah, you know, go there all the time. And who else is in this space, you know, that I follow? Trace Mayer is really fantastic. Andreas Antonopoulos, he put out a lot of videos. Which are very good. And Peter Todd, you know, if you want to get more of a technical thing, yeah. He's got some really great, you know, videos out there. And so what do you think is going to be the next stage in this ride? You know, more philosophically speaking, what are we going to see in the next couple of years as money becomes Napsterized, as money is taken from the central banks? The central banks get redundant. So what does that mean? I mean, we talked about people's individual sovereignty. We get that a lot. But what does it mean? What else? Go run with that a little bit.
I mean, that's going to change the game significantly. So, you know, we're already at a point where there are so many honeypots out there because now this digital money is a lot more tempting for hackers to try to get to, because once they get it, no one can take it away from them. We're gonna, I think, see some, you know, innovative new types of criminal activity, and we're gonna see some innovative new types of commerce and regular interaction from an economic standpoint. So I'm very interested to see what happens when we can create a completely new type of economy, especially one that's like based on microtransactions. You know, trying to get to that, what I would ascribe as a crypto anarchist or anarcho-capitalist utopian voluntary future on the internet. One example of that might be the Yours platform, where you're paying micropayments to authors, and you know, instead of having advertisements.
Ryan Charles X.
Yep.
I follow him on Twitter as well.
Yeah. So. You know, the idea
Yours, that, Y-O-U-R-S. So yeah. It's micro. Anyway, I think we're out of time, right? But, okay, it's an excellent idea. Microtransactions enabling more peer-to-peer and the financialization of everything we do in society without any intermediaries whatsoever.
Making the incentives more clear by actually paying people, you know, when they give us something of value. Now that it'll be so much easier to pay tiny, tiny amounts.
All right, cool. Jameson Lopp, thanks again for being on the Kaiser Report.
My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Jameson Lopp. You can find him at Twitter @Lopp, L-O-P-P. If you want to reach us on Twitter, it's Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.